first evening. Questions? TC was really worried earlier that there's only one question in there. Maybe you should make an announcement. I said, well, there's Q&A would be at 7. I wasn't going to solicit. There's lots of questions here. First question. I'm guessing that the accountant had little chance of finding his way to Nibbana unless he ordained. Do you know if he did? Actually, I think the sutta ends with him realizing stream entry, and as a layperson, and doesn't say that he took ordination, so that he continued with his duties and firmly sort of in the stream of Dhamma. So it's possible. All things are possible. Okay, it's a question. I have a cancer and finished my treatment and afraid it will come back if I don't take care of myself, as the doctor told. So it is my stress. How can I think to make my stress to be possible in mind? Maybe it's more like to be to hold it so it's not overwhelming. That's a way to consider. I mean, I think, you know, with some serious illness, and particularly cancer, which has a lot of imagery, perceptions, associations around it, then it's quite, those are difficult perceptions and associations. So that to recognize that it is serious. It's not so, another cancer here today. It's not like that. It is serious. One needs to be to take care of oneself, and those are oftentimes really good opportunities for making changes in one's life that one has really contemplated or known one should, but then the motivation levels go up real high. So to be able to hold it in that way, and then also to recognize that the obsession is a kind of stress itself, so that becomes we can burden ourselves with even so-called right thoughts, right thinking, so that we're trying to do everything the right way, trying to do it properly, it can be very stressful. So that really paying attention to what's the mind doing? How can I hold this? How can I be, take this seriously without it being a burden? And those are, that isn't accomplished just through wishful thinking and one doesn't get it right off the bat. And one has to be willing to keep investigating, keep working with it, so that there's a certain diligence in looking after oneself, a recognition that one's not totally in control, and to a sense of well-being in the mind or a sense of gratitude in the mind, in the heart, that's when, well, whatever it is, I've had the opportunity to have this human birth, have the circumstances that I found myself in, the ability to make really skillful choices in my life, and to really to work on that, so that there's a sense of real appreciation and well-being that arises. Those are a few thoughts on that. Question is, what is the difference between yoniso manasikara and insight? Well, one, I think, is one is cause and the other is result. So that yoniso manasikara is a way of directing the mind, directing attention, utilizing the mind, and insight is something that can arise. Of course, then we have to take insight, or whatever insight arises, and then direct attention skillfully with that. So it's sort of like the yoniso manasikara, wise attention, considered reflection, are the, maybe like the tools or the ways that we apply the mind. And then the, insight, understanding, knowledge that arises is an effect of that. What do you do when there are ants at the monastery? Is there a way to get rid of them naturally without killing them? I had to get rid of some a week ago and witnessed three ants die somewhat painfully by what I used, which caused both sadness and remorse in me, and I don't want to do it again. But what is, quote-unquote, right action? There's the precepts versus what is practical. There are ants at the monastery. I think there's, I can't remember what the statistic is, but the number of ants compared to the number of human beings is very, very different. Oftentimes, really paying attention to, one, what's attracting the ants, being able to, to get rid of what is attracting the ants, like really keeping things clean, keeping things tidy, keeping things so that there isn't anything that will attract them. That's a really important aspect of it. And also, there's there's some natural deterrents can keep them away. I'm trying to remember. I think one is it's like tea tree oil. Another one is it cinnamon or something? Oh, cayenne pepper. Yeah, they do not like cayenne pepper. Having some of that around, and then they disperse. But I think one of the main things is really trying to figure out, okay, what's attracting them? Sometimes they're attracted to one of the kutya, I think the one that Hector's in, but they love the insulation. rigid insulation is really a bad idea for any kind of Buddhist building. that it's just the greatest little apartment dwelling for large communities of ants. Then it's sort of an ongoing battle where you're putting down things like tea tree oil and cayenne pepper and trying to keep the way in, and then they manage to find a route, and in the end it's I think we'll probably end up having to rebuild that cabin. it's one of the very first cabins that we built. It wasn't one of the most well-constructed ones. In Thailand, what they do is everything's on stilts, more or less, like pillars, so that it's up off the ground. Because, Thailand, tropical country, you really have insects and various life forms trying to get to you. One of the pillars will tend to have like oil around the base. You build it so that there's oil around the base and then a cover so that rain can't get into it. And then they don't like the oil. So then they don't go up. Nothing goes up. And then they can't get around it. So you figure out preventative ways of dealing with it. Question. This must be from one of the Thais in the group. Could you tell us your stories related to the King Rama the Ninth of Thailand? It's a for those who don't know, the King of Thailand passed away about, well, it was in October, so maybe it's 2 months now? Yeah, 13? Yeah, so October is about 6 weeks or something. No, it's 2 months. And he was the king for 70 years, so the vast majority of the Thai people, that is their reference point for him. Leadership, and he was there for 70 years. So. And he was a quite an exemplary leader. And at Arcatina, there's a few people here that were here at Arcatina, and that was the passing of the king was very fresh in everybody's mind, and I'm not sure how many say that day. Maybe in the hall there's about 250 people. Outside there's about another 150, and probably at least a third were Thais that were there. So then they asked to a part of the that day. And the Katina, they asked if there was a shrine made in honor of the king, and they asked to sing a kind of song or anthem that is, it's kind of like a national anthem, but it's a particularly for the King of Thailand and the recollecting the barony of the king, the wholesome qualities. And it was very moving, and even for, say, those of us who didn't understand what was being said, the emotion behind it was really very, very palpable and very moving, really. In terms of stories of the King of Thailand, he was many things in terms of he was a devout Buddhist practitioner, a good and diligent meditator, He was a musician. He was a sports person. He won a gold medal in the Southeast Asian Games with a little sailing dinghy that he had built. So that, you know, he's just multi-talented and spent a lot of time in development work, thinking through ways that could be a benefit for developing the country. And most people don't get to meet the King of Thailand. But one of the passions that the king had was photography. So that he liked taking pictures and documented things. And when Ajahn Chah passed away, then it was a state funeral. King and Queen of Thailand were present at Ajahn Chah's cremation. The Prime Minister of the country, lots of people, plus 300,000 or 400,000 others. But of course, it's very special when the King and Queen come, and so they came in, and they do. Normally, they come in for a ceremony like that, and they make an offering of robes, they make another offering, light the ceremonial pyre, and then they leave. It's sort of in and out, it's a done deal. But then, of course, the Ajahn Chah's funeral was very special in that we had been practicing together at Ajahn Chah's monastery through the year, but then really focused for about almost 8 days, yeah, eight days, I guess. And the numbers of people practicing in the monastery at that time, there's about 5,000-6,000 monks. There's about 500 or 1,000 nuns. Same number of laymen, and there was about over 10,000 laymen, laywomen, sort of staying in the monastery, practicing regular schedule, chanting, meditation, Dhamma talks, and what that did was create an atmosphere of, I mean, Wat Phong is already, Ajahn Chah's monastery is already a palpably peaceful place. Then, with that practice being done there and creating the container, then people coming from all around the country to pay respects were kind of part of that, and it absorbed it and settled it, so that that period of time, there's probably, you know, 1 million people came through the monastery, and then on the day of the cremation, these numbers are hard to count, but probably 300,000 to 400,000 people there, and then the king comes in, and king and queen, and preside over the occasion of the ceremonial lighting of the funeral pyre. And normally, as I said, he would come in, do the ceremonial bit, and then they'd leave. But that day, I think he really felt touched. And he just sat there and took pictures, and everybody else, of course, just sat there. I think the government officials were probably getting antsy as well. They're used to not having to sit And but anyway, he just really tuned into that piece of the dedication that was there. And we heard later from people that we knew in the palace that he was really touched by the atmosphere and the presence, and he'd always had a lot of respect for Ajahn Chah. Another story that stood out for me about the King of Thailand was in 1967. I've never read about this, I wasn't there. But President Nixon was visiting Thailand, and he was attending a state dinner. I mean, especially at that time, America had a huge presence in Thailand. It was kind of the height of the Vietnam War. Thailand had many air bases that were there, a huge amount of military aid coming in. And at the state dinner, President Nixon then related to the assembly there that he had earlier that day had an audience with the King of Thailand, and he was saying, and he asked a question that he asked of pretty much all the leaders that he would meet. He would ask, what is it that I could give to SAS, or America? What can America give to you? What do you need from America for your country? And he said he was really impressed with the king's answer, because the king answered understanding. And that was really, that's really indicative of the quality. Because, I think President Nixon was used to getting answers to that as either, money, financial aid, military aid, some kind of trade deal, or whatever. And the King of Thailand lifted it up to another level, and I think really appropriately, as a country, or in any kind of human relations, the king recognizing that what we need most is not material things from people or some kind of advantage in some way, but what we need is understanding. And it's just so essential. So. Okay. Does the Buddha say all beings are inherently good? How about generosity? Do all human beings have the capacity for generosity? I think it's important to parse out the language, in the sense that, say, all beings are both inherently good and inherently irritating, and with the whole spectrum, but all human beings, I think, do have the capacity for generosity, and I think we have the capacity for appreciating generosity. It's just very human quality. We're just this mix of all these different say when I said like the when the Buddha is sort of saying that that say the fundamental mind is say is radiant. It's sort of it's radiant when it's not being clouded over with selfishness and greed and obstructions. But I think also that you know the Buddha points to generosity as a doorway. Like today, I was speaking of it in terms of the effect that it has on us and practitioners and as practitioners. But this is a fairly select group of people that are already making efforts in their life. But I think even people who are really not very good or virtuous people, even they can be generous, and that draws them closer to, so that the Buddha put that quality of generosity as a doorway or an encouragement. One of the things that comes to mind is a occasion when Ajahn Chah was a student of Ajahn Chah's had a person come to them kind of in distress and dissatisfied with his life. He was a mafia boss and controlled a large gang, a lot of illegal activities, a lot of violence, and was dissatisfied. And so then the student sort of thought, oh, this is out of my league. I better get Ajahn Chah in on this. So he took him up to Ubon and introduced him to Ajahn Chah. And it was really interesting. Ajahn Chah had him stay with him, like underneath his kuti. I mean, it's very rare that anybody get to stay under the Ajahn's kuti. But had him stay and just had him help out. Kept him close, gave him things to do, gave him things to help with, gave him things to, that he could give and to be generous and to share and to help. And he stayed for like a week or 10 days just living underneath Ajahn Chah's kuti. And then, of course, he had time to chat with him and pour his heart out to him. And I remember, because I was actually staying at this little branch monastery or little hermitage, because he came back and then told his gang that, okay, from now on, we're going to conduct business in a way that we're not going to break precepts. And it was like, because one, he had a brother who was younger brother who was a kind of partner in the business. and sort of, what do you mean, what we're going to do? How are we going to do that? So we'll figure it out. Yeah. So but anyway, that was it was that generosity was a doorway to be able to commit to something deeper. So, I think we all have that appreciation of generosity, and so I think that generosity is a really important doorway for many, many reasons. Okay. There's a request for me to speak at some point about practicing with physical pain, and then how to say work with that and work with it, say a tendency to sort of disassociate from the body when pain's severe. So I'll probably find an opportunity to plug that into a Dhamma talk. I'll probably send this on. At the Friday evening talk, you mentioned the three poisons, kleshas, of greed, hate, and delusion, but you also added fear. Fear seems more like a result. Please explain. Well, it's important to know that there's different ways that the Buddha spoke of the things that are poison, stains, defilements within the mind, and kind of the you know, like the mula kilesas, the root defilements, greed, hatred, delusion, lobha, dosa, moha. But then the Buddha points to, in other discourses and other expressions of his teaching, then he'll point to different ways that say the mind also say gets stained or gets caught. So that the list that I was pointing to was what are called akati, and it's usually translated as bias. Literally, it means kind of like leaning. How a bias, we lean in a particular direction, or we are leaned, we're pushed in a certain direction. And that, in the root kilesas, greed is loba, and but in this one of akati, then it's chanda, chandakati, dosakati, mohakati, bayakati, and so chanda in this sense is a bit broader. It's just desire, but it makes the mind lean. It creates a bias in the mind that taints how we experience things. That the bias of dosa, of ill will, of anger, the bias of moha, delusion. But then last one, bhaya, as fear, is a bias within the mind. And, you know, on some levels, I mean, of course, I mean, there's maybe, say, when you come back to, so you've got root defilements of greed, hate, delusion, you can come back again and sort of root defilement of either liking, disliking, on two, or you want to come back to a root defilement of avijja, of lack of true knowledge. I mean, there's different ways of, these are different ways of parsing experience. But the experience of fear is, you start realizing how much fear drives us and how much fear does create this leaning in the mind. And sometimes fear, we try to allay fear by indulging in something that's pleasurable. A sensual desire is fed because it helps to assuage a certain underlying fear, underlying kind of anxiety, so that and similarly with you know, our say our and so we get protective or irritated or and you know, oftentimes it's more fear based than is we're lashing out. Not because of any some strong belief, but it's more like there's an underlying fear there. So that quality of that expression of fear as a say as an akati, as a bias, as a way that the mind leans, is really it's an important investigation. And as I say, the Buddha expresses or parses things out in many, many different ways. You know, you start, it's like the 16 upakilesas. I mean, that's not, it starts making it, sort of parsing it out even in just different expressions of stains of the mind. But and I think fear, in the sense of that, this akati, fear is an important aspect, and you know, and it is a say it can be a result certainly, but you know, results and cause they go back and forth; they feed each other. And but it certainly say, Abhayagiri, as a monastery, I mean that's what it's. Name is fear is bhaya, abhaya is non-fear or fearless, it's fearless mountain. Giri is mountain or hill. So that there were many reasons for naming, using the name Abhayagiri, but certainly one of them was that sense of, oh yeah, a place of fearlessness, of not being, that one can come in as a place of safety, place of refuge, where one doesn't have to experience fear, or one has a safe place to feel fear at least. So then I saw that as an important gift to bring into the world. So that's all the questions this evening. Mm-hmm.